right, on the Johnson Auto Plaza hotline, I want to bring in ESPN legal analyst in Las Vegas, founder, co-founder, I guess, of Battleborn Legal Injury Attorneys in Las Vegas, Nevada. Justin Watkins, my friend. Justin, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Dan. How are you?
Well, I wanted to give you a chance to get your victory lap because you and I, so we go on Cofield's we go on Cofield's legal podcast. You're on there every week. I'm on there a few times a month. We do a Law and Sporter podcast on Thursday nights. And you and I were just kind of arguing over this, what the Supreme Court might do. And so I said, this came down. I wanted to get Justin on and say, Justin, congratulations. You got your wish. You guys have ruined college athletics forever. Congratulations, Justin.
Well, I have to say that one of the interesting things about reading the Supreme Court's opinion on this case was to hear about the history college athletics and the false narrative that there ever was such a thing as amateurism involved in college athletics. From the very beginning of all of this, college athletes were paid. They were paid ringers, and then they created the NCAA, and they were paid then. Famously back in, the 1950s, a running back for Washington said he was the first college athlete to take a pay cut to turn pro. He didn't know if he could afford to go pro. So,
he said, I can't afford to graduate. I can't afford to graduate because boosters leave, huge stacks of cash under my pillow every time I score a touchdown. I can't afford to graduate, right? That was in the opinion.
I didn't know any of that stuff, so the Supreme Court did a great job of writing up the history. But I will say, in our debate, one thing that I pointed to about the inequities here was the monopoly of the NCAA and that there was no viable choice. And you said, sure, there's a choice. They can go play elsewhere. They don't have to play at all. And the thing that struck me that I haven't heard anybody talk about yet is the NCAA did this to themselves. They created the nomer of student athlete. And what the court, the district court, the Ninth Circuit, and the Supreme Court all agreed upon in this antitrust lawsuit is that a student athlete was its own industry. They weren't an athlete and they weren't a student. They were a student athlete. And in that definition, the NCAA has a total monopoly. So by the NCAA creating this amateur label of student athlete, they did themselves in this lawsuit in the antitrust definition. And that was good to see because, frankly, I've been cheering for it. I think it's the right decision. And, I'm really interested to see what happens next.
Well, and another thing that was interesting was they also did themselves in another respect in that there was another part of it that was like, if they hadn't been for so long, so kind of magnanimous about you guys you'll get nothing and like it, so to speak. Like you can have a bagel, but you can't have cream cheese. You can really just have nothing. And if you don't like it, go pound sand. They were just like so, so strict. And by the time, I don't know what it was in 2014 and in recent years, like, okay, well, now we'll give in some and we'll start giving you some money. It was just too late. Like it was just not enough. And there was some language in there, but like, had you been more reasonable? Because like you said in the beginning, it was like, okay, this started with like Yale and Harvard or Ivy League schools. They had these contests and then it was just a bunch of ringers. I think one of the presidents said, this is out of control. The NCAA was created to stop, rampant, paydays. And then, the sanity code was created to, like, clamp down on, basically stuff we saw out of, like, SMU and Oklahoma, back in the 80s. And so, yes, there was, like, this prohibition on, boosterism and stuff like that. And so there was, like, this, the sacrimonious, we must make sure that these athletes don't get paid. But in the end, Justin, isn't that what kind of at one section of the opinion they were talking about was like, you guys were so dang sanctimonious and you went so far in starving these kids and making sure they got nothing that now you got to pay the piper.
Well, I think it's that part and the fact that they were not themselves sanctimonious. So if they had stuck to the model of, hey, we're just here to regulate and make sure everybody's on the same playing field and enforce the rules that you all agree upon, fine. But what they noted throughout the opinion is This is a billion-dollar industry. And for the NCAA to come in here and say, yes, we make billions, but we are providing a valuable service to the community and society and educating these young men and women and providing for college athletics, we are not to be judged under antitrust rules like any other industry. The court, like, so far rejected that notion and said, no, you are absolutely an industry, and you are a business and commerce industry that should be looked at and analyzed under the exact same antitrust laws as everybody else, noting the billions they brought in on television contracts, noting the hundreds of millions of dollars each of these conferences made, and then giving the athletes nothing, essentially, in comparison to the money that was made. They said, no, 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 you open this door by making this money. And now you can't, what the ultimate opinion came down to is just because it's good for the consumer does not mean that it is pro-competitive. It has to be pro-competitive, on both the input and the output. That means pro-competitive in the labor market and pro-competitive for the consumer. And this is not pro-competitive behavior for the labor market because you are price fixing, and that is, by definition, antitrust.
Okay, now, other industries do not have to deal with Title IX. I've only had a quick moment to kind of look up from the NCAA website how Title IX applies. And because of the way this opinion says is, they can have unlimited compensation, but it still has to be related to educational stuff. It seems to me like Title IX is still going to apply to this money. How do you think this is going to shake out in practice? And if they're giving college football players a bunch of money, are all the other sports going to say, well, we got to get our piece of the pie? And because of that, then I know schools are already looking for reasons to cut a bunch of other programs because we've seen that during the pandemic. Like, are we going to see schools now just be like, goodbye, other sports?
Yeah, so I'll try to keep this as brief as I can, but let's put into context what this decision really says, okay? Because everybody sort of, you know, the general population is saying, well, wait, I thought this was already taken care of in the Ed O'Bannon case, okay? Ed O'Bannon's case pertained to name, image, and likeness. Who owns that and who gets the profit from it? And, you know, basically seeing your name and your information on a video game that you never got paid for because the NCAA says they own it. Is that appropriate? Ed O'Bannon, as everybody knows, won that case. And so now we have name, image, and likeness belongs to the student athlete. How are they going to be compensated for that? Still unknown. You know, Congress has not weighed in on it. A bunch of states have. But that is only one portion of the pie. The next portion is, okay, what about the restrictions the NCAA imposes in regards to compensation related to the athletics? So their athletic performance and the compensation that is given. So the scholarships, that athletic scholarships, any sort of prize money in bowl games and the food, room and board that's associated with all that, can they fix the prices and come along a compensation plan for that? The court, in this case, the Supreme Court, did not address that issue because the underlying court ruled in favor of the NCAA there and said, yes, that's appropriate. They can do that because the only viable pro-competitive element to that is that we think if college athletes were compensated the same way that pro athletes were, it would harm the industry because there is a distinction in the mind of the consumer between pro athletes and amateur athletes and the payment they get. Now, the last piece of the puzzle is education-related expenses. And what the NCAA said is the argument's the same. Our student athletes must not be paid because the consumer wants them to not be paid. And it is part of our, you know, it's how our industry defines the student athlete. The court rejected that and said, no, no, no. What makes you unique is that the athletes are students. And anything that's pro-education only further enhances your distinction from pro-athletics and therefore is not pro-competitive for you to limit the compensation related to education expenses. I know this is getting somewhat convoluted, but what are we talking about here? We're talking about
tutoring, academic awards, postgraduate tuition and scholarships, post-eligibility scholarships, those kinds of things. It's very, very limited scope that this court opinion applies to. In that situation, the court says it is not appropriate to the NCAA to limit it without reason. And the reasons must be somewhat specific. One example is the academic awards can be limited in the same way that athletic awards are, which is, I think, is $5,900 on a yearly basis. You can't do more academic awards than that. And with that definition in mind, I agree with you, Title IX applies. Because Title IX says there must be equal rights provided in women's sports as men's sports as it pertains to the student athlete. And I think education-related awards and expenses must be equal in order to comply with Title IX. So if the worry is that all the big money schools are going to give all these academic scholarships and academic awards that go out there, they must do that in line with the women's sports as well.
So how do you think that'll turn out in practice? If Alabama and Texas A&M just go completely nuts to try and get all the best, football players and maybe basketball players, how is that going to look in practice?
I actually don't think this is going to make a big change in regards to the direct compensation for athletes at this moment. I think the bigger part of what this ruling means is where Justice Kavanaugh was trying to go in his concurrent opinion, which is to say, hey, the student athletes didn't appeal their portion of the ruling, but they should have, and they would have won. This is illegal, antitrust, anti-competition rules that exist. Athletes should be able to challenge this, and I think that they would win on the grounds of compensation of any sort. And the more important part is, while I'm the only one who's writing about that, the court is unanimous that the analysis that they will look at for any challenges to the NCAA on antitrust grounds will be the same grounds that any other industry will receive, which is a reasonable relation rule. I won't get into the standard of review. That's boring to listeners. But in essence, Kavanaugh and the court invited future litigation to challenge all of these other things.
Well,
I
heard that. He came off a little bit as a blowhard, especially since, none of what he was saying was binding. And the one big industry he was leaving out was all of the major professional sports leagues, are not all of them, but, some of them that have salary caps. I know what you're going to say, Justin, is, they already said that the student athlete is a monopoly, so they can't, I guess maybe they can't have a salary cap because there's no union, I guess. I don't know, but why couldn't the NCAA just say, we can say if you want to be a part of our industry, then we're going to have a salary cap, because this opinion did say that conferences could set up their own rules, right? And the SEC could say, if you want to be in our conference, you're going to play under a salary cap or something like that. Like Kavanaugh conveniently left that out.
Well, major difference between what you're just said, pro sports and student athlete, is the salary caps are collectively bargained, right? The athletes have a say in the rules that govern their industry. The student athletes have never had a say, don't have a seat at the table. And so the court, they still can address it on antitrust grounds. But as you know, some of the sports have for a long period had antitrust exemptions through Congress, and some of them have given them back. NFL gave it back, so we don't want the antitrust exemption anymore. And so when you have a collective bargaining agreement between the labor and the employer, largely the courts aren't going to want to disturb that for antitrust grounds, right? They can, but they're usually not going to touch it on the basis that the input, the labor force is anti-competitive. They can always challenge it on the output side that it's not pro-consumer. They can do that. But remember, the challenge to the NCAA on these antitrust grounds was on the input side, that they were inappropriately price-fixing the labor. And so that, I think, is the distinction between the pro and amateur sports. But I will say, I tend to think that if some of the schools take this to heart, you're going to see the Ivy League type schools, the better educational institutions benefit, I think, a little bit more here than you're going to see the traditional sports schools, because the educational benefits are, they're going to have more resources for the educational benefits, where the other schools might have their hands tied a little bit more on the athletic side.
Hey, real quick, our last story before we have to go here. Frank Clark from the Chiefs, also in the AFC West, busted for having an Uzi, apparently, in the car. What'd you make of that? And obviously, if he's convicted, could face a league suspension. Your quick rundown on that story.
Yeah, so in California, it's illegal to have a concealed weapon in your vehicle. There are some exceptions. If it's in a lockbox, if it's in your truck, if you're using it and transporting it for hunting purposes, but I don't think that any of those are going to apply based on the facts we have so far, which is that the Uzi was in a duffel bag and sticking out. How the policeman saw that on a routine traffic stop, I'm sure that is going to be a point of contention for the defense attorney, and whether or not the stop was a pretext for something else and it wasn't really about a traffic stop. But assuming everything is correct, that the stop was correct, that the Uzi that was found was concealed, then he's going to be in trouble. I mean, I think this could be escalated to a felony, which means that the weapon wasn't legally owned. I'm sure it's not legal to buy an Uzi in the state of California, but maybe he got it legally from some other state. I don't know. But that can escalate the crime from a misdemeanor to a felony if the gun is illegally possessed.
At Justin Watkins at BattleborneJW on Twitter. We thank you so much, sir.
All right, thanks, Dan.
All right, always good talking to you, Justin Watkins. All right, your chance to react coming up next.